This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 130 was recorded August 30th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. We're back from Toronto and back to our regular show format this week, and Patrick has a fantastic fall guest lineup on deck. We'll kick it off with author and former Federal Reserve insider Danielle DiMartino Booth, returning as this week's feature interview guest. Danielle and I will discuss everything from why Draghi and Kuroda didn't show up for Jackson Hole, to quantitative tightening, to the Q4 economic outlook, to inflation risk, and much more. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when we'll give you both extended equity market coverage as well as a full rundown on Macro Voices Live in Toronto, including when you can expect the videos to be made available, as well as our thoughts on organizing future live events for the Macro Voices audience.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Now, Eric, when we were wrapping up the show for the summer, we're talking with everyone about the August potential rally in the S&P 500, and we were targeting whether or not it's going to make 52-week highs, and certainly the market has not disappointed. We've got a big surge up. We're approaching 2920 on the upside of the S&P. A little bit of selling right here going into the close. What's your take on the S&P here?
Well, as we discussed for a few weeks before we took our summer break, you know, the big question was, is this going to be a failed rally that's below the previous high? Is it going to be a double top, or is it going to be a break to new all-time highs? We got the answer. It's clearly a breakout to new all-time highs. And I think it's important to recognize, you know, as much as I have immense respect for many of our expert guests who have confidently said on this program, okay, look, the top is in. You know, it's time. This market's way long in the tooth. It's past due. It's time for this thing to turn around. Well, guess what? That view has really been invalidated. A lot of those people said the top is in. The top wasn't in. And it really makes me think, Patrick, boy, you know, if there's one rule that really just trumps all others, it is that markets never crash when everyone is expecting them to. And there are so many people who have predicted that this fall is when we're going to have the big one. There are so many people that are hedged against it. And that means that as that doesn't play out and we move to new all-time highs, they're forced to lift those hedges, and that means more buying that propels the market even higher. So for so many reasons, I think we could be looking at the beginning of a melt-up from here to much higher equity prices. And believe me, I am the first to say it makes no sense whatsoever on a fundamental level. This should have been over a long time ago. But if you look at what's happening, I think the argument that equity markets are really the only alternative because everything else is so overvalued, maybe we're starting that melt-up. That was really the view I was starting to come to, Patrick, but then I saw the chart book that you sent me that we're going to get into much more detail in our post-game segment, looking at how emerging markets are just falling apart. That really is a strong signal that maybe this really is the beginning of the end. Is this a false breakout to new all-time highs that's about to reverse dramatically? I'm not sure, but it's going to be very telling. Certainly the next month or two is going to be pivotal and clearly important to watch carefully in terms of gauging where this market is headed. Let's leave it there for now, though, but I want to come back to your chart book in the post-game segment and go much further into what's going on with emerging markets.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, because we got that very decisive breakout again above that 95 level that we were, well, 95.50 or so, where we kind of drew the line before we wrapped things up in August. And we got this big breakout, and it really looked like it was following through. We were at the show live, and we were talking about this big breakout having some legs, and yet it seems like the dollar index has completely taken a break and given it all back. I personally am still a little bit bullish on this dollar, but it certainly has lost its mojo here for that breakout. What's your take on the dollar?
Well, Patrick, so many people were expressing surprise on the breakout above 95. I don't know what they were surprised by. It seems very clear to me that the global marketplace was reacting to news from Toronto of Macro Voices Live being a great success. This led to the, oh, okay, maybe that's not the explanation for the dollar breakout after all. Wishful thinking. But seriously, it did happen to occur on the day of Macro Voices Live, which was kind of interesting. That breakout above 95 moving very quickly up to 10. 97, that was a textbook move. We had been fighting resistance at 95 for quite a while. The fact that there was a sudden acceleration all the way up to 97 didn't surprise me at all. Now, retracing back down to 95 round, in other words, taking what previously had been resistance and testing it as support, that would be perfectly expected and also textbook. The thing is, we didn't just come down and test 95 as support. We broke through 95. We've been trading on a 94 handle for almost a week now. So what does that mean? Normally, I would say, this is reason to question things, because where 95 had been the key level before, we broke it as resistance. It should have come back in as support. So far, it hasn't been holding. The thing is, Patrick, if you look at what's going on with the dollar now and you view it through the dollar index, which is very heavily weighted to the euro, yeah, boy, it looks like the dollar's faltering here. But if you look at the dollar relative to all the emerging market currencies and pretty much everything else besides the euro, yeah, the dollar rally is still intact. So my view of this is what we're seeing in the dollar index as a little weakness here below 95 is probably more a reflection of strength in the euro than it is weakness in the dollar. The dollar has remained strong against other currencies, and I think that's going to be the thing to watch. Certainly if we stay below 95 for a whole lot longer, it's reason to question, at least on the dollar index, whether that rally is set to resume. I'm leaning toward the case of more upside for the dollar, including the dollar index. It's just a question of how long this move in the euro takes to play out. In any case, let's come back to this, because I know you've got some charts of the dollar relative to the euro, as well as other emerging market currencies that we can get into in the postgame segment.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more, Eric. Now, let's move on to crude oil, and let's start off with that inventory number. How did the numbers come in this week?
Well, it was drawdowns across the board. Crude oil drawing down 2.6 million barrels. Nationally, there was a very small build in Cushing, Oklahoma of 58,000 barrels, so at least the big drawdowns that we were seeing in Cushing for a while have finally slowed down. But gasoline and distillates both drawing down 1.6 million barrels and 837,000 barrels on distillates. So we're seeing big drawdowns. Exports continue at 1.8 million barrels a day, about 12.5 million barrels of oil exported. Production flat, supposedly, but remember, they changed the reporting rules, so they round to the nearest 100,000 barrels, which has really made that production number that comes out from EIA weekly almost worthless. It's still 11 million barrels, which really means it's anywhere within 50,000 barrels on either side of that. We can't really tell on a weekly basis what's going on with production. Across the board, inventory draws are obviously bullish, and when we hit every category like this, needless to say, the price has been moving up.
All right. Well, Eric, back in July, we were talking quite a bit about those time spreads and how they were developing. And has anything happened throughout the month of August that you want to update us on?
Well, the charts basically say it's over. We had that August, September, and September, October spread just blowing out to crazy wide numbers. There was no contagion into the October, November, and November, December spreads. They're holding at much more reasonable levels. So it seems like whatever the big squeeze was is over, and that is definitely confirmed by the fact that once we saw the spreads not showing contagion into the new months as the previous ones were expiring, that led to a sell-off through August 15th that took us down quite a bit, and I think that pretty much confirmed the market saying, okay, this short-term squeeze situation or shortage that existed in for physical oil in Cushing, Oklahoma appears to be over. That's also echoed by higher inventory numbers that are starting to come back in Cushing with a build this week, even as the rest of the market was showing drawdowns across the board on all the other categories. And the strength I think that we've seen since August 15th has been driven by other factors. So I think the situation with the spreads is over. A result of that was the sell-off that we saw that played out, and now we're seeing some strength coming back in from so many question marks in other parts of the market.
So, Eric, where does that leave us in terms of the bigger picture? Are you bullish or bearish here at this point on oil prices?
You know, Patrick, I really don't have a very strong conviction in either direction from here. I thought that we got a little bit low around the 15th of August, all the way down around $64. And, you know, we're back up to almost 70 now. There are so many moving parts between Iran, Venezuela, Trump trade wars, what happens next with the ECB. There's just so many moving parts here that I really don't have very strong directional conviction. Right now, the trend has been up. Let's see if it continues.
All right. Well, you know, I'm going to work on getting Art Berman back on the show. Maybe he'll give us some updates in terms of where he's thinking oil's going next. Nonetheless, let's move on to gold. And gold here, obviously, we had some pretty heavy selling in the early part of August. We hit the lows down around 1170. When everything sort of stabilized temporarily, gold managed to pop back up to about 1220 on the upside. But really nothing that impressive relative to the magnitude of the selling we've been seeing in gold. What's your thinking here? Is this just a play on the dollar still?
I think it is, Patrick. And, you know, a lot of gold bugs were calling for a bottom. They said, okay, we broke just temporarily below 1,200 down to, I think, 1,167 was the low print. That's the bottom. The bottom is in. That's it. You know, didn't these same guys say the same thing at like 1,320 and then at 1,280 and then at 1,250 and then at 1,220? I think if you look at what was going on when these moves happened in the dollar, it's pretty clear. We saw this breakout right beginning on the 10th of August, the day of Macro Voices Live, that took us up dramatically. And as that breakout began and we moved up toward 97, gold sold off. Dollar up, gold down. Just as we were hitting the high on the dollar index around August 16th, gold bottomed. And what we've seen now is the dollar, after testing 97, is back down below 95. So it's no surprise that gold has pushed its way higher. I don't see the logic behind the people that are saying, okay, the bottom is in. If you think that the dollar is done here. And Patrick, we should probably mention, Jeff Sherman from Double Line was the one guest we had on the program who said 95 is not the number to watch. Look at 96.5, 97. That's as far as Double Line thought the dollar could go before it would reverse and move dramatically lower. If what we're seeing is the beginning of Double Line being proven right, in other words, 97 was the high, we're going to hang out here at just below 95 for a little while, and then the bottom's going to fall out of the dollar, well, in that case, then Goldbugs got it right, although, frankly, I think it was a lucky call more than a skillful call in saying that that 1167 was the bottom. The scenario that I think is much more likely, Patrick, is if you look at what's going on with the dollar relative to non-euro currencies, the rally is still strong. I think it's going to continue. I think the euro is going to participate eventually, and I think that the dollar is going to move higher and gold is still going to move lower. Now, to be sure, gold will have its day in the sun. I think if you look at the really big picture, step back and say, look at how overpriced stocks are. Look at how overpriced bonds are. I mean, good heavens, all this negative yielding sovereign debt around the world. Bonds are at just ridiculously high prices. Stocks are at high prices. What's left that's cheap? What's left that's cheap? The answer to that question is going to be gold. I don't know that we're quite there at the bottom yet. And I think that the way to play this is to look for a definitive change in direction on the dollar. When you see that decisive change and the trend has changed, the dollar's not moving up anymore, it's definitely moving down, maybe that's when it's time to buy gold. But I still think it's a little bit early.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yields. And when I pull up this chart here, Eric, I mean, this looks, to any junior technician, it looks like a big head and shoulders topping formation developing with the two shoulders around 3% and the head of the head and shoulders up at the 310 when we had that poke up there. Not only do we see something that looks like a blatant topping formation, but we have record levels of short interest in Treasury bonds at a period where usually bonds tend to behave as as a risk-off asset. And it's interesting to see what will happen here. Do you think that this is going to break down? Are we going to see yields decisively lower here, or do you think we're just stuck in this range?
Well, I definitely think that there's plenty of ingredients here for a short squeeze, if nothing else, that takes us back to, say, 260 on the yield. Remember, of course, a short squeeze means up in price. That means down in yield. As far as what happens next after that, once the short squeeze plays out, is there really reason to see dramatically lower yields after everybody's been shaken out? The market loves to prove people wrong, and oftentimes once it's proven them wrong, the trend reverses direction after that. So I don't know what's going to happen. I definitely think, though, if you look at the tape action, you know, we're back down to 286. For a couple of weeks there in early August, we were testing the top of that narrow range right up in the 290s. Now we're back in the middle of that narrow range between about 280 and 3%. It's the wider range that I care about, from 260 to 310. When we decisively break, let's say, on a weekly or better yet, on a monthly basis, below 260 or above 310, that's where I think maybe a serious trend is in motion. Which way it goes, there were more people betting that Treasury yields were headed higher than there were betting lower. Usually the crowd is wrong, so that would make the argument for lower. There's also an argument for a short squeeze that takes us briefly lower and then eventually proves out the higher case. So I think it remains to be seen. I don't really have a strong fundamental view about where this is headed, other than we've been in this trading range for a long time. And as the old saying goes, the longer you base, the higher in space. So whichever direction we move out of this trading range, it's likely to be a big move.
This week's featured interview guest is author Danielle DiMartino Booth, and also the founder of Quill Intelligence. Eric's interview with Danielle is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Danielle DiMartino Booth, author of Fed Up. Now, Danielle and I spoke off the air and agreed, since we already did a full-length interview on the book, we're going to leave that alone. But before going on, I just want to suggest to all of our listeners, if you missed that interview, it was an excellent one. Fed Up is an excellent book. It's the inside story from Danielle's experience at the Dallas Fed, talking about how the Fed works from an insider perspective. It was a fascinating book. I couldn't put it down. We've decided not to focus on that, though. You can go back and listen to that entire interview. It's still there, free of charge, at macrovoices.com. Danielle, let's move on. That book was entirely about the historical perspective of all the things that have been wrong with the Fed and your experience, and you've been very outspoken in your critique. There's a new horse in town, though. Jay Powell is a different kind of Fed chairman, or so it would seem to a lot of people. What's your take on Jay Powell? Is this guy a different story? Are you optimistic, or is it more of the same?
I am cautiously optimistic. I have not founded the Jay Powell fan club just yet, but many of the things that he has done since becoming chair of the Fed, I predicted that he would do and held my breath, and then he did them. So I'm happy as a barking seal. One of the first things I wrote about him was that he had no agenda at all. He did not have to be at the Fed. This is a gentleman who worked for a dollar salary to educate the Congress on the perils of the United States defaulting on its debt, and has absolutely no political fight to pick. He has no economic agenda. He's not a PhD in economics, so he doesn't sit in a Keynesian camp or an Austrian camp, for that matter. He's a pragmatist with a markets background and appreciates the intersection of the two. And he also cares for taxpayer dollars, because one of the first things he did, which I implored him to do, was to implement a press conference after every Federal Open Market Committee meeting, which, as we know, is beginning in January. So that means that we have 8 live meetings a year instead of what we've been contending with since Bernanke imposed the press conference at every other FOMC meeting policy years ago.
Now, the Jackson Hole retreat that the Fed holds in August at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, as I understand that, it's kind of a get everybody together so that the entire global community of central bankers have a chance to have a powwow and talk to one another and so forth. This was Jay Powell's first Jackson Hole, kind of an important thing. Mario Draghi, the head of the ECB, and Kuroda, the head of the BOJ, the two other major central banks in the world, didn't show up. Is there a message there? Is this something that we should be concerned about? Is it a vote of no confidence in Powell somehow? Or did these guys just happen to be busy doing something else in August?
You know, I'm really not sure, but I will say that there is no such thing in this life of ours known as coincidence. So I certainly think that there was a message to be communicated in their not being there. I don't necessarily think that the philosophies of the old school Keynesian doves, more is more, print, 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 I don't think that that necessarily aligns with Powell's views. And if you'll recall from just the year before, or maybe it was 2 years ago, I can't recall which, but one of the most famous pictures was Yellen and Draghi and Kuroda walking down a path in Jackson Hole and laughing with one another. Those were probably three of the most prominent doves in the world at the time. So I don't know if it was something as simple as philosophical differences on how monetary policy should be made, or if it was more, you know, this is when Trump had just called the Fed out and was definitely putting the Fed under a lot of scrutiny. And I'm not so sure that they didn't want to avoid it for political reasons, given the fact that the trade war had not been resolved at that point, and it still remains unresolved.
I want to come back to the trade war, but let's start with Powell's performance. He was there, certainly, at Jackson Hole. What did you think about the way that he conducted himself and the policy decisions and discussions that occurred there? How would you rate him as opposed to some of his predecessors?
Well, he was extremely plain spoken, so you didn't need to get Google Translate to read his speech. You were able to read it from top to bottom and understand exactly what he was talking about, even though it was certainly not nothing of a lightweight speech. And he very much put on show the fact that he has become an astute student of economics since he joined the Fed in June of 2012. But by that same token, he also raised some issues in that speech that I think very few picked up on, one of which was the fact that he noted that the prior two downturns had been preceded by signals that were emanating from the financial markets that were not inflation related at all, and therefore the Fed should be mindful of indicators other than inflation in helping them set monetary policy going forward. And that is truly a departure from the orthodox we've had since Greenspan took office over 30 years ago.
Let's come back to the trade war subject. You know, President Trump has declared that trade wars are easy to win, making it so simple, it would seem, at least in a tweet. That kind of throws a lot of baggage into the central bankers' laps. If all of a sudden trade wars are easy to win and not challenging, which not too many people seem to agree with President Trump on, what are the implications in terms of monetary policy and what central bankers will face in this political environment where the president has declared that, yeah, trade war is a good thing and they're easy to win?
Well, I think what it does for the Fed is complicate their mission, especially because the old Fed would say that they were data dependent, but they were truly model dependent. And Powell is a departure from that in that he is truly data dependent. And when you introduce a trade war that is going in many different directions with many different countries, the dollar is stronger, the dollar is weaker, interest rates are up, interest rates are down, Turkey's blowing up, Argentina's blowing up, inflation is up, inflation is down. This noise is one of the most distracting, debilitating factors that complicates a central banker's task of making monetary policy to ensure stability. The way Trump has gone about fighting this trade war that he instigated has been to introduce volatility to monetary policymakers' tasks. And I don't envy Powell and the others on the committee with what they're being tasked with, given all the noise they're having to wade through.
Now, a lot of people had predicted that when eventually we got to quantitative tightening, the phase that we're coming into now, that would mean that the benefit, the tailwind, if you will, for the stock market that we've felt for the last several years would reverse to a headwind. And some people have even predicted an outright crash in equity markets as quantitative easing is replaced by quantitative tightening, which, put another way, is the unwind of quantitative easing. Are you concerned about the outlook for equity markets as we move into this? And what do you see on the horizon from the Fed, from the ECB, and the Bank of Japan into year end in terms of policy and how it's going to affect equity markets?
Well, if all goes according to the plans that were laid out originally at the start of the year, we should have the liquidity that flows into global financial markets cut in half from $2 trillion in 2017 to $1 trillion in 2018. And I can promise you, I was one of the people warning that there would be highly detrimental effects of this reversal of policy. What I had not anticipated, I'm not so sure that anybody anticipated, was the ease with which the tax bill was passed through Congress, given it was somewhat potential political tinder, and the fact that the worrywarts, who were concerned the bulk of the money that came back on shore via repatriated profits would go into share buybacks. Really, it's happened as the people were worried that it would happen, and it's gone very quietly into the night because it's benefited the stock market. So I don't know that we can necessarily say that equity markets, that the stock market right now is reflecting quantitative tightening, but I don't think there's any doubt that the bond market is.
Let's take a look at the U.S. dollar. Over the last few weeks, we saw the dollar break out after fighting resistance at 95 for about 3 months. We finally saw that decisive breakout on the 10th of August, took us all the way up to just barely testing 97 on the dollar index. But now we're back down below 95 again, and I think some people are starting to question whether or not the Fed is going to stay the course on tightening. I think some people are getting concerned that an appreciating dollar both poses risks to emerging markets, and of course President Trump has been very outspoken saying that he wants to do everything that he can to avoid letting the dollar appreciate too much. Do you think that dollar appreciation is part of what is coloring the decisions that Fed policymakers are making, and how much do you think the direction of the dollar is going to influence their decisions going forward?
I think right now the dollar is much more a manic reflection of the day-to-day news flow in the trade talks. I think that if you look at the correlation, that that's where they're kind of tied at the hip. I don't think that the dollar is going to sway the Fed one way or another as much as the fact that animal spirits have run wild and inflation appears to truly be in the cards and well above the Fed's target with every single metric except for the core PCE.
Danielle, let's tie all of these concepts together and get your overall view as to where we're headed for the rest of the year in terms of the economy. And particularly, you mentioned some discontinuity between the stock and bond market. Do you expect that to continue, and what do you see on the horizon there?
Well, I think that the long end of the yield curve, I think the 10-year benchmark treasury, is telling us one thing about the future. And I think that the 2 years telling us something completely different. And I can't disregard, as so many people have suggested, the message in the differential between the two, because it's kind of hovering around 20 basis points, which is a dozen-year low here. And I think that what it is saying is that if you look at producer price indexes, and even on a global basis, they look as if they've peaked and they're starting to come back down. When I think of producer prices, and I think that this is a great benchmark, I associate them with growth. And I think that producer prices are being reflected in the 10-year. They're coming off their high. Yields are coming off of their highs. And I think that that is advertising that after the sugar high of the fiscal stimulus that we've had, after the sugar high of the repatriated profits makes its way through the share buyback pipeline, after that happens, then what for the economy? Then where are we headed? And again, I think that that is the quandary that we're seeing in the 10 years' inability to cross 3%, to say nothing of the fact that every time it does, an emerging market blows up. But by the same token, the other benchmark that I look at to gauge the Fed is the consumer price index, which lags far behind the producer price index. You can think of a pig going through a python. So what we're seeing with the 2 year being very resilient is the fact that it looks like the Fed is going to be chasing inflation. We know September the 26th is going to happen. It's fully priced into the markets. The question then becomes one of, is it going to be December or is it going to be January? Because I do think it's going to be one or the other, unless, as Jay Powell says, in his data dependency, we see the economy fall off a cliff in the fourth quarter. And I'm increasingly concerned that that is going to happen. The two leading sectors of the economy, automobiles and residential real estate, have already begun to advertise that the best for the cycle has come and gone. And that typically presages economic slowdowns.
So you have a fairly bearish outlook for the fourth quarter, and it sounds like your view is that the Fed is, if they see this in their data, likely to change course. I want to come back, though, because you started this with a discussion of consumer and producer prices. A lot of guests that we've had on the program have said they think that this inflation scare that we're seeing is a head fake, that it's not going to last. Others have said, no, it's the beginning of a secular increase in inflation. How do you see this?
I would like to think that the economy could withstand a period of rising prices and that the economy could withstand the higher interest rates that went along with it. But again, I think that I would put myself a little bit more in the head fake camp, again, because of what producer prices are doing. So producer prices are advertising loud and clear that as soon as the supply chain disruption is rectified, as soon as the inventory rebuild has come and gone, we've seen extraordinarily strong inventory numbers just these last few days, in fact, and that's going to filter its way through to stronger than expected third quarter GDP growth. But as soon as you have that inventory rebuild, and because we've seen a lot of prices come off of the super high levels, as resolution is found with Europe, as resolution is found with Mexico, and looks like resolution will be found with Canada. At some point, it really is going to just be a big fight going on between the United States and China. So as the tariff scare comes off of a high boil, so will the panic buying that accompanied it come off of that same thing. And so the impetus is going to be for prices to come back down.
And you say as soon as we come off of a high boil, it sounds like you think that the trade conflict with China is mostly in a negotiating phase right now. We're going to get to the point where everybody calms down and backs off of the strong positions that they're taking. Am I interpreting you correctly?
Well, I think what some sage advisor has told the president is a fact, and that is that we can afford the trade war much better than China can. And because they depend as much as they do on being a critical cog in the global supply chain, and because they continue to depend as much as they do on their export sector, I think that somebody has told the president that he has the upper hand in negotiations, and that if push comes to shove in this game of chicken, that China will back down. Now, we don't know that that's going to be what the end result is, but I think that that is how he's being advised, and that is why we're seeing other opponents with whom he'd had a trade or tariff beef begin to fall like flies. And again, I think last man standing is China.
And what other risks does this pose to smaller emerging market economies as this game of chicken is playing out?
I think that countries that depend on China having a robust economy at all times, which they can typically engineer if they're not fighting a trade war on the side, I think that the real risk is to commodity exporting nations such as Australia, such as Chile, and what the implications hold there. But as far as emerging markets go, I would go back to our earlier discussion about the dollar and about whether or not the 10-year can break 3% to the upside. Because again, when you're talking about emerging markets, at least in my view, if you're talking about a country like Turkey, you're talking about dollar-denominated corporate debt that got it in trouble. In other countries, it is dollar-denominated sovereign debt. But again, the common denominator here is the fact that it is dollar, an overabundance of dollar-denominated debt. So I think it is the 10-year that people are going to key off of, and or how aggressive they believe the Fed is going to be, and whether or not that strong dollar causes a teetering emerging market to be toppled.
Danielle, let's move over to Europe and look at the situation the ECB is in. They have at least advertised their intention to wrap up their tapering and move toward a quantitative tightening phase, which the Fed has already begun. What does that mean for the ECB and particularly for Mario Draghi's successor?
Well, I think that the situation is becoming increasingly tenuous for the ECB, for Europe. There are several different moving pieces, one of which is the fact that even the Germans, even the most hawkish Germans, contend that we won't even see the first rate hike, assuming the taper ends by December, that we won't even see the first rate hike until the end of next summer. So we could be talking a year from now and still have their discount rate at a negative 0.4%. And even after that first rate hike, the assumption is that they would only take it up to negative 0.2. So I've written in my weeklies, I've written in my dailies about the prospect for economic textbook writers of a major economy going into recession, potentially following other countries as they teeter into recession, going into recession with negative interest rates. That will present policymakers in Europe with a huge conundrum, because one of the reasons that they're having to push through with the taper, because Draghi is the most dovish person on planet Earth, but one of the reasons that they're having to push through with the taper is mechanics. They're simply buying too much of these markets. And they're learning that they potentially have other ticking time bombs, like the company that was downgraded to debt and looks like it's going to be liquidated, that they had bought and put onto the ECB's balance sheet. There's so much uncertainty going forward because they're moving so, so slowly. And then you look at the lead German contender, who's now in fourth place. A few months ago, he was in first place. Again, I think that replacing Mario Draghi is becoming an increasingly unattractive proposition. And that's just one of the moving pieces. The other one, my maiden name being DiMartino, so I can say exactly what I want about those crazy people in Italy, because I'm one of them. But the other problem, I think, is Italy. And they recently polled the public, and public support for the new government has not wavered one bit. And they continue to heighten the rhetoric. And we know that the economy in Italy is slowing anew, that youth unemployment remains a huge problem, and that the new leadership remains focused on the euro and the debilitating outcome of Italy having moved to the euro, and the fact that it can't therefore print its way out of its massive debt load. So I worry about the future of Europe, given the fact that their bond market is so much more overvalued than ours is, and the fact that so few investors really pay attention to that dynamic and how it could possibly bleed into our market one day, and why we should pay close attention to places like Deutsche Bank and their derivatives books. I can't believe I'm saying something like this as we approach the 10-year anniversary of Lehman Brothers.
Let's talk a little bit more about that situation, because I couldn't agree with you more that the European debt situation, and it's not just sovereign debt. There was a story on Zero Hedge. I can't remember the name of the company, but there's actually European junk bonds, corporate junk-rated bonds that are yielding lower than the U.S. 10-year. And it's just shocking that you have that kind of overvaluation. It seems to me like European junk corporates are the bubble that it feels to me. I guess what I'm really asking is, what is the thing that's most ready to pop? If you had to short something, and of course, shorting any kind of high yield is dangerous because you've got such a big carrying cost. What's most ready to pop? What's the thing that is most at risk? Is it European sovereigns, the negative yielding sovereigns that we have in Europe? Is it the very low yielding junk that we have? Where is the real low-hanging fruit for a short seller who's waiting for this all to blow up?
Well, to your point, I would add that European corporate junk bonds are not just on their face extremely overvalued. It's also an infantile market. In prior cycles, the European corporate sector depended predominantly on the banking sector to provide most of the funding and financing. So it's not just a matter of the price and the overvaluation of the paper and how rickety the underlying collateral potentially is. It's also the fact that this is an untested, very young market to have had investors crowd into it as they have. And again, I'm not so sure that mom and pop investors here in the United States don't sleep well at night thinking, well, gosh, that's Europe. And well, I go to Europe. I don't worry about going to Europe. So surely European bonds are good too. Again, I think that there is a lack of awareness among U.S. investors in terms of what they own and where it is and what the potential is for capital losses, because in a generation, we haven't had to contend with capital losses in bonds because we've had interest rates ticking down towards the zero bound for as long as anybody in their careers can remember.
And as long as anyone has ever had experience with. We don't have anyone living in professional finance now who's been through this in the other direction. And I guess that really makes me wonder, when this does turn around, when we see that secular change in interest rates, which a lot of people think is just around the corner, it really is going to introduce a new paradigm for everyone to get their heads around. Do you have any thoughts on where the trade is here? Is it a pairs trade that's long U.S. 10-year and short European sovereigns, or is it a European long sovereign versus short junk? Where's the trade?
Well, I wouldn't be long much of anything in the European bond market, whether it be sovereigns or not, just because, again, of the situation that you outlined in Italy. I am intrigued by the naysaying there, and in fact, this is what I'm going to write about in my next weekly newsletter. Right now, we're being told to discount two things as investors. We're being told to discount the yield curve, and there have been reams of reports that have come off of Wall Street that have said the yield curve does not matter. We need to disregard it and carry on. And now we have another school of thought that says that we need to disregard the record short position in U.S. Treasury, specifically the 10-year. I get really worried when stories that say it's different this time begin to multiply like bunnies.
Well, it certainly is a very difficult question on my mind as to what's going to happen with this 10-year yield next, because it is record short interest. But frankly, Danielle, I think sometimes people lose sight of the fact that those commitment of trader reports are describing the short or long interest in those Treasury futures. The Treasury market itself is much bigger than the Treasury futures market. And I think that that misleads some people. But I still wonder what's going to happen here, because there's a good case for Treasury yields to move higher, but there's plenty of strong argument for a short squeeze. I've been waiting for one, and I've been surprised that it hasn't happened yet.
You know, I have as well. But again, sitting at 20 basis point differential between the 2 and the 10s just tells you that even though the 10-year hasn't come crashing down, that the 2-year has maintained a lot of support holding that 2-year yield up. So again, I look out towards the fourth quarter, and absent some massive DC-based stimulus, and given the fact that, you know, we just had another disappointing pending home sales figure, buyers are truly stepping back. Drive around any neighborhood in America, and you'll see that the for sale signs are popping up everywhere. And sometimes, as Warren Buffett once said, you need to be able to kick the tires. Some economic data should be prima facie. It should be in your face and start to communicate to you, okay, something's wrong with this picture. And again, I can't see over the horizon into the fourth quarter and tell you with any conviction what is going to propel fundamentally the U.S. economy into the next stage.
Danielle, we introduced you to our audience as an author of your excellent book, Fed Up, but that was backward looking at what the history of the Federal Reserve has been. You have, since your last interview, launched a new business, which is Quill Intelligence, that's more forward looking than backward looking. Please tell us about it. What have you got in the works?
Well, you know, what I learned from being on Wall Street about Wall Street research, and especially about economic research, was that it tended to look backwards. You know, if you can't seasonally adjust a data series, well, then it's disqualified automatically. But what good does that do investors? So Quill Intelligence is a company that has been founded on trying to anticipate, find where we are, constantly ask the question, look for the leading indicators to see where we are in the cycle, good, bad, or in between. And that's why some of the discussion that you and I have had today, a lot of it's been guided by what I learn on a day-to-day basis, that the number of buyers who are encouraged by home prices has come crashing down, while the number of sellers who are encouraged by rising prices has gone way up. That tells you a lot more about, for example, where the housing market is headed than any kind of a lagged existing home sale report might, to say nothing of what a realtor's opinion is going to be. I go on and on. But my point is, the reason that we founded Quill Intelligence was to provide individual mom-and-pop investors, it's called the Daily Feather, with something that's going to be written in plain English that does not look backwards, but rather looks forward into investing and economic trends, that is easily digestible, 4.5, 5-minute read with a chart they're not going to see anywhere else. And the uptake has been absolutely tremendous, and as well as the feedback. I was on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, and somebody walked up and said, "Hey, you're that feather woman." And I said, "Yes, I am." So I like to say that we are launching a research revolution, and there's no hyperbole there. We're going to change the way research is conceived and delivered.
I don't know that I would dare to walk up to a Texan and say, "You're that feather woman, aren't you?" I fear the consequences. But I want to thank you, though, for being as generous as you've been. Not only have you launched this new business, which obviously is a paid subscription, but you have made several issues of the Daily Feather available to our Macro Voices listeners. And listeners, you'll find download links in your Research Roundup email for some sample issues. You've got several of them here. One is about an auto price shock in the making. You've also got another one about credit cycle word association. You've got another one about the journey to the core of inflation and so forth. Give our listeners a sense of what they can expect to find when they check out these sample issues that you've included for us.
Well, they can expect to find a tiny bit of history on a given economic indicator, and then hopefully at the end of every feather that you read, you come away saying, "Gee, I never thought that X was connected to Y, but I'll never forget it going forward." And that's what we want. We want readers to attain financial literacy, but at the same time, start like Russell Crowe in A Beautiful Mind, start to connect areas of economic data and financial markets that they didn't really think about before.
And once again, the name of the newsletter is The Daily Feather. There are several links. I want to thank you again for a fantastic interview, Danielle. And I also want to remind our listeners, go back and check out Danielle's prior interview, which is entirely on the subject of Fed Up, her book about her experience as an insider at the Dallas Fed, which was a fascinating interview. Danielle, thanks so much for another great interview. We look forward to having you back sometime soon. Meanwhile, Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, once again, another great interview with Danielle. It's always great to get some interesting insights on what things are developing with the Fed and what the policy will be moving forward. Nonetheless, let's move on right to Macro Voices Live. We had this great event. It ended up being so fantastic. It was such a pleasure meeting so many of our listeners and hearing their feedback and views. And just it was amazing how many people came from all over the world and joined us. And, it was great to have also so many of our actual guests all in one room at the same time. I think it was just great. What's your feeling about the show?
Well, Patrick, it was incredibly flattering and gratifying and impressive to me to meet so many of our listeners and to realize what a passionate and engaged listener community we really have. Probably the most striking moment of the event itself for me was just in the first few minutes when I asked by show of hands, how many people actually got on an airplane and flew internationally just so they could come to this event? And well over half of the people in the room raised their hand. We had something like 75 people who had flown internationally just to attend Macro Voices Live. Frankly, I feel like we let people down by not negotiating with some hotels to get discounted hotel room rates. We had no idea that anybody was going to need a hotel room. We didn't know anybody was going to fly in just for this. And it really woke our eyes up to the strength and passion of our listener community. probably the most striking thing to me was after the event, one gentleman went home after attending Macro Voices Live and promptly made a $1,000 donation to Macro Voices. Got another $500 donation just today, Patrick, from another attendee at the event. So people paid for their ticket, liked it so much that they made very significant donations, and quite a few $100 donations have come in since then. So, you know, I am just so flattered, and it makes me look forward to figuring out how we can engage our audience more. It was fascinating to me that the strongest feedback we got, both at the event and in the survey that we sent out after the event, is people actually valued the interaction and networking with other listeners as much as they valued the presentations by our featured speakers. And it seems like there is a really passionate community of Macro Voices listeners who want to get to know one another and who want to get to know us and attend live events. And so, you know, we never knew. We put this thing together really on a whim, having no idea it would be so popular. And I can't tell everyone how personally flattered and appreciative I am. Those donations that we've received from attendees afterwards, they just say so much, and it is incredibly flattering to me to have built a listener community that's as passionate and engaged and intelligent. Frankly, you know, Patrick and I have both done a lot of public speaking. These events are usually full of boring people that ask, talk your head off with dumb questions. Everybody that attended was fascinating. We had so many great conversations with all of our attendees, and I really look forward to having more opportunities in the future to get to know our audience better.
All right. Well, I couldn't agree more with you on that, but I want to move on because we want to talk about the videos, right? We obviously had it really well videotaped, and our editors are on this right now editing the videos. What's the expectation in getting these videos out to our listeners?
Well, we've gotten all kinds of emails asking about this. I hope we've responded to everybody, but in case not, here's the story. We are pedaling as fast as we can, folks. We really want to do a good job of producing professional quality video. This stuff takes a little bit longer than I expected because we're trying to do a good job. So we hope that by next week's show, we're going to be ready to release, I'm going to say, at least half of the presentations, if not all of them. And again, as we've announced in previous shows, the deal is going to be that anyone who has donated at least $50 to Macro Voices, don't be afraid to donate more than that, folks, in 2018, we'll receive full access to all six videos, plus our town hall, which was actually a discussion forum that was more popular with the attendees than any of the individual presentations were, which was also fascinating feedback for us to receive. So the way this is going to work is if you have made a donation, your Macro Voices account will automatically reflect that. All that you will need to do is log in at macrovoices.com. Using the username and password that you registered when you first signed up for the Macro Voices Research Roundup emails. Once you've logged in, there will be a place on the menu that tells you in the research library where you can see the Macro Voices live videos, and that will be enabled automatically if you've made a $50 or larger donation in 2018. There's nothing there right now. We are working on editing these, and we expect to hopefully have at least the first few of them ready by next week, and certainly within the next week after that, we should have the rest of them done. So we're working as fast as we can, and we look forward to getting them to you just as soon as possible.
Now, I want to get over to the chart book in just a moment because we have lots of stuff to talk about in the markets. But, you know, after such a successful show, I'm sure many people are asking the question what we're thinking in terms of maybe potentially doing some of these future events. Why don't we quickly share our thoughts on what we're thinking here for maybe doing another Macro Voices live event?
Well, Patrick, this really creates a conundrum for us because I personally have never been more flattered than I was by just how much enthusiasm and excitement on all the people flying in from all over the world, which we never expected. It just makes me want to say, boy, let's really knock their socks off and make the next event even bigger. Let's make it a couple of days. Let's have more speakers. Let's add this idea of a VIP pass that allows you to actually get some personal FaceTime with the speakers. speakers, go out to dinner with them and so forth, an idea that was very popular when I discussed it with a number of attendees there. Let's really, really do a great job in the next one. The thing is, neither you or I are in the event production business, and this stuff starts to turn into a lot of work pretty quickly. So we're kind of struggling. I've talked to one professional event planner who says we're not quite big enough yet to justify hiring an event planner to run this whole thing for us. As we look at this, the logical thing to do next would probably be to choose a U.S. city, because that's where a lot of our attendees came from and where a lot of our speakers are. Well, if we do that, frankly, we'd need to create a U.S. entity and get it a merchant account so we could accept credit cards. We don't have a business set up to do this. We were able to do the Toronto event because your company, Big Picture Trading, is already based in Canada and set up to accept Canadian dollar payments on credit cards. We're not set up to do that in the U.S., so we'd have to set up a new business. We want to do more. We're trying to figure out what the best path forward is. We might do another Canadian event just because Big Picture Trading is already set up to process the credit cards on it. We might do a U.S. event at some point. We want to. It's just a question of figuring out how we're going to fit this in with our busy schedules and the fact that this is not really what we do for a living. So we're working on it, and we welcome further feedback from listeners. Please feel free to email us or tweet us or whatever you like in order to make suggestions. We'll certainly consider them all, and we'll let you know as our thinking evolves in coming weeks. But Patrick, speaking of evolving thinking, I want to get back to our equity discussion from the market wrap, because until I looked at your charts on emerging markets, I was really thinking, boy, as much as it doesn't make sense to me on a fundamental basis, it seems like maybe we're looking at a breakout to new all-time highs that might have some legs. Maybe we're going to see a melt-up into the end of the year. And then I looked at those emerging market charts. So let's go to that chart book now. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. It says Postgame Chart Book. Walk us through this, Patrick, starting with the S&P chart. What are we looking at here on the S&P? And maybe from there, we'll transition to some of the emerging market numbers that are more reason for concern.
Absolutely. Well, obviously, we've been sharing this chart book with our listeners for a better part of at least 4 or 5 months. And one of the things that we've targeted on this chart book was what we called our target zone for a breakout, which was this area looking for the retest of the previous highs to maybe as high as 29.40 on the upside. Now, that's just a technical measured move. There's no magic to it. It's something that we do in our technical master's program. And so we're approaching and finishing this move. But like you talked about it earlier, this is where in the past we have seen sometimes these parabolic breakouts that can just see the market blast off. And to be honest, I am not even close-minded to that actually happening. It's very reminiscent of the kind of conversations me and you had back in November, December when Bitcoin was going mental to the upside. We both knew that it wasn't going to last for another year, but it could significantly go higher before the big reversal. And I sort of feel like that about the S&P. But what I found problematic with the idea of the S&P melting up is the substantial divergence we're seeing in terms of how the rest of the world is behaving. And, you know, on page 3, we have a chart of the dollar index, which we kind of talked about that in the pregame when we're talking about that level at 97 rejection and where we're trading right now. What the dollar index doesn't tell the story of is how significant certain emerging market currencies are breaking down badly. I mean, yeah, if you look at the headlines, you see Turkey, you see Argentina, you see all these things, but it's very hard to kind of size up the magnitude of the moves unless you actually look at some of these charts. So starting on page 4, I have, first of all, just a chart of the Chinese yuan, which is just showing the material breakdown that we have seen in, you know, the second largest economy in the world and the weakness we had there. But it's really pages 5 where we have the Brazilian real. And in the month of August, we've had this material breakdown to fresh new lows and sustained distribution and selling in the Brazilian currency. You go to page 6, there we have the Argentinian peso, which has literally in 4 months lost 50% of its value. And just even the last 48 hours has seen seen a, literally a free fall occurring in this currency. We go to page 7 and we have the Indian rupee, and we have a fresh new lows for August and continued sustained selling. We turn around and go to the Turkish lira, and already, even after a little bit of a bounce in the middle of August, we find ourselves right back down at the lows of August and potentially breaking to even lower lows. Even the Turkish lira, like the Argentinian peso, in the last 7-8 months has lost again almost 50% of its value. So we're seeing the emerging market currencies in full breakdown mode. And the dollar index that we talk about all the time is not accurately depicting the real dollar shortage story and how the rest of the world is reacting to it. But what I wanted to get to and get your thoughts on here, Eric, can we have this type of capitulation in currencies continue without at some point the stock market starting to care? You know, there's this old adage in the stock market that nobody cares until everybody cares, and then everyone cares at once a whole lot. And the question is that with the stock market here in the U.S. pushing to new highs, everyone is sort of passively saying, well, these currency things are happening and the market's not reacting, so we're just going to continue to bull higher. But what happens if there's this moment where all of these emerging market currencies just capitulate and it creates some sort of event, and then we have a market shock? Is that something that computes in your mind?
Well, I think you're already seeing it in terms of the currencies. I mean, these currencies are in utter collapse mode, in free fall relative to the dollar. So we are seeing the Jeff Snyder dollar squeeze higher scenario against emerging markets playing out exactly as Jeff has described it, and exactly as we've predicted and discussed on this program. What's going on is that the euro is showing some particular strength, and that is skewing the dollar index chart. So it looks like the U.S. dollar is not appreciating as much as it really is, because after all, 57% of the U.S. dollar index is the euro currency. So when the euro is strong, it definitely impacts that dollar index chart. By all other measures, the dollar is continuing to rally, so we see the dollar continuing to be strong. That's one of the reasons that I'm not super bullish on gold here, even though a lot of people seem to be turning bullish on gold. And I think the real question that this is going to invoke is, okay, if what's happening is dollar strength is leading to an emerging market crisis, as a lot of people feared it would, if that's what's happening, is that going to cause the U.S. government to change its ways and say, wait, we can't let this happen? Or are we going to get back to that? I can't remember which U.S. official famously said, when somebody asked him about, you know, look at what's happening in emerging markets, he said, well, it's our dollar and their problem. Are we going to go back to that? Certainly with President Trump's attitude of America first, it's very possible that the U.S. government is not going to give a lot of concern to what's going on with respect to emerging markets. And I think that the U.S.-China trade war situation is potentially going to exacerbate this further. So what's the consequence? If emerging markets are falling apart and that's causing debt losses, at what point does that actually get transmitted to the U.S. stock market? And I'm not sure. At some point, as you say, it has to, because eventually those emerging market debt losses are going to come back to haunt us. So far, it's really pretty striking to see the trajectory of the U.S. stock market indexes are not showing that there's a problem by any stretch of the imagination. It's isolated to emerging markets. How long can it stay there before the contagion moves into U.S. markets? I don't know the answer.
You know, the one thing that I was going to comes to mind is that if you can recall back in 2007, when the subprime was breaking down, banks were suffering, we had a Bear Stearns moment, we had all these things deteriorating, no different than today. Emerging markets are deteriorating, and yet the stock market managed in October of 2007 to make a fresh new high, and it just defied at the time the conditions that were deteriorating around it. Wouldn't it be interesting if that was something that develops here? Like, what if this is sort of a fake out to the upside of the market, and the deteriorating conditions around will ultimately prevail into next year? I don't know, but you know what? We have no shortage of interesting guests we can bring onto the show to give us some insights on whether that can actually happen.
Well, and to carry that analogy a little bit further, Patrick, I think you make a really interesting point, which is so many people have got their mindset on this idea that, okay, it's 2008 all over again. This fall, folks, what if this is the big one? What if it really falls apart? October is where it's going to be all over. Well, what if they've got the basic analogy right, but it's not 2008 all over again? What if it's 2007 all over again? And what we're moving into right now is September of 07, a year before everything really fell apart in 08. There were certainly a lot of things wrong in September of 07. I thought the market was overdue to crash in 07, but you know, it took another year before it really happened. So I think, so as you say, Patrick, in October of 07, when a lot of people, myself included, were thinking the crash was overdue, we actually got new all-time highs. Maybe that's what we're seeing right now, and we've got a while left before this thing really plays out. It's going to be very interesting to watch.
Absolutely. Well, moving on just very quickly to charts 10 and 11, I'm just showed the iShares MSCI Emerging Markets Fund, as well as the VanEck Vectors JP Morgan Emerging Market Local Currency Bond ETF. And what's really interesting is that this is a synchronized drop. Not only are we seeing emerging market currencies declining, we're seeing the emerging market bonds dropping. And at the same time, we're seeing emerging market stock markets dropping. It's like a perfect storm. You know, we talked about that kind of a perfect storm eventually happening in the U.S., where bond stocks and the U.S. dollar all are moving at the same time in the same direction. But yet here we are, and we literally are witnessing that happening in the emerging markets. I wonder where, you know, what stops this? What's going to reverse this? Is this something's been set in motion here that is deteriorating pretty quickly?
Yeah, and it's going to be very interesting. It seems very clear that the emerging markets are falling apart. So at what point does that present a contagion risk to developed markets, and particularly U.S. equities? The other question, which we haven't really gotten into in this discussion, is, boy, look at the European bond market. As Danielle DiMartino Booth pointed out, European bonds are more inflated even than U.S. bonds. At what point do we eventually, you know, prick the bond bubble? And what are the implications of that? So it's going to be very interesting times, to say the very least. Before we close, though, I want to move on to slide 11, because you've got a 7-day complimentary pass for Big Picture Trading. For anyone who's a newer listener and doesn't realize it, Patrick is in the business of teaching people how to trade markets. He teaches classes on macroeconomics, on technicals, and particularly in options. Give us a sense, Patrick, of what our listeners can expect from their free 7-day membership pass to Big Picture Trading.
Well, the 7-day pass does give access to our daily analytics, as well as all of the trade alerts that I publish on an ongoing basis. Themes that we talk about here on the show, I express as trades and often overlay different option strategies in order to execute them. And so those people that are trying out the free trial get to see what trades we have on and what we're thinking in the market. So anyone interested can email us at info@bigpicturetrading.com.
And that is free, means really free. No credit card required, no fun and games, no BS, just free access. See if you like it and take it from there. Well, on that note, Patrick, it's time for us to wrap the show. Listeners, I can't tell you how much I just am very personally flattered by the feedback that we got from Macro Voices Live. It really was a high point in my life, and I look forward to meeting more of you and eventually figuring out how we can organize more events. Meanwhile, we need your help promoting Macro Voices, so please tell your friends and colleagues, forward your research roundup emails, and most importantly, if you haven't done it yet, shame, shame, go to macrovoices.com and register your free account. It only takes a couple of minutes. We won't spam you or try to sell you anything. The benefit to you is that you'll receive our free research roundup email every week, which gives you both a reminder that the podcast is out, as well as access to downloads of all of the coolest stuff that we could find on the internet, including supporting materials associated with our podcasts. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
All right. Well, you'll find the transcript for today's interview with Danielle, as well as the link to that chart book that both of us discussed here in the post game. There's also a really interesting article discussing Europe working on an alternative to the SWIFT system for financial independence. And, you know, when we talk about all this de-dollarization, you know, I think this is a headline that certainly continues to see the world moving in that direction. There's also an interesting economic letter from the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco titled Information on the Yield Curve and Future Recessions. And it goes through what the different yield curves are telling and about forecasting recessions. So it's a great read from the San Francisco Fed. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners. And we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. So on behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.